Okay, James chapter 11, James chapter 11, James lecture 11, it's chapter 4, verses, actually 13 to 16 is what we're on right now. James states here that the principle that you should put God first in your business. If you're a businessman, put God first. And take a look at verses 13 to 16. James says this: "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." So James says, put God first in your business. Businessmen are not in full control of their future. All creation is not in full control of its future. The future is uncertain. Man is limited in his power. And man is temporary. His physical life on this earth is temporary. That's what a vapor is, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. And so businessmen should recognize they're not in full control of their future. You can come up with the perfect business plan that looks like, hey, there's no if, what's, or buts. This plan is going to work. And then as soon as you put on your suit tomorrow morning and grab your attaché case and go out on your front porch, there could be an earthquake and you get swallowed up and die. You don't even control the amount of oxygen that enters into the earth's atmosphere. So the idea that a businessman might have that he can create his own reality or just decide, hey, I will do this or that, and my plans will come about, period. It's that attitude, that arrogance that James is talking about here. Now, this is much, you know, the poor man fails left and right. I mean, the poor man tries to go and find some temporary work to bring food home, and he fails to find temporary work, and his family goes hungry that night. So he's used to failing. So it's very unlikely that the poor man's going to get real arrogant. But the rich businessman who's had success before can become overconfident and could get to the point where he thinks that he absolutely controls his future and that he can know with certainty that he's going to succeed in his business ventures. Another aspect that James is hitting on here is that the meaning of life, the true meaning of life, is to serve God, not the self. Okay? So it's finding whatever service God has for you to do, not just you trying to serve yourself and build your own kingdom. But assuming we fully control our destinies is arrogance, and such arrogance is sinful. Only God is in full control of our destinies. John chapter 16, verse 33, Jesus is speaking. He says, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage, I have overcome the world." And we can have tribulation that will knock us around, that will kick us around, but we are to turn to Jesus. Jesus is the one who has overcome the world, not us. Jesus is the one who overcomes our problems, overcomes our circumstances, not we ourselves. But Romans 8:28 is probably the key passage here. To the astrologer, we would say that the stars don't control our destinies. To the overconfident businessman, we would say he doesn't fully control his destiny. God alone is the one who fully controls our destiny. Romans 8:28, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good, to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." Now, I'm not one who believes that we don't have free will. I believe that we do make free choices, but God, in his sovereign plan for our lives, knows what free choices we would make given certain circumstances, and that is part of the data that he looks into when he predestines the course of life for us.
Is that known as the doctrine of middle knowledge?
It's middle knowledge would agree with that, but I'm sure there's guys who hold that position that don't necessarily hold the middle knowledge. They would probably just end up either with the mystery view like Geisler, man is free, God is sovereign, how they're reconciled, we'll never know, that type of thing. Or they might try some other way, but I've never heard, other than middle knowledge, which came from Louis de Molina, it's called Molinism or middle knowledge. It's a way to reconcile God's predestination and human free will. I think Arminianism overemphasizes human free will and does damage to God's sovereignty. Consistent Calvinism overemphasizes God's sovereignty by doing damage to human free will. I think Molinism alone has a strong view of divine sovereignty, obviously not as strong as the five-point Calvinist, and a strong point of human free will without doing damage to God's sovereignty. But the course that we taught in soteriology dealt with that. But basically, only God is in full control of our destinies. Now, I want to say this. James is not... What is bothering James is not the terminology of these businessmen. You know, James isn't the kind of guy that if I say, yeah, tomorrow I think I'm going to go watch you, I'm going to go to the kingdom and watch your Mariners game. James isn't going to say, oh, you should say, if the Lord wills, tomorrow you're going to go. James isn't the kind of guy that wants us to always, you know, come out with if the Lord wills after every sentence we ever make. That's not James's point. It's an attitude that James is getting at. The attitude that you think that you're going to accomplish all these goals irregardless of what God's will is, and the assumption, the arrogant assumption that you are in total control of your life as if you create your own reality by the choices you make. You know, it's like the positive confession movement today. That's what James is attacking, that false attitude that doesn't give God his due and doesn't recognize God as the sovereign king of the universe and that only he is in full control. Now, I do think that, okay, the health and wealthers and the Christian scientists, the mind science cults, they give man way too much control of his life. Man does not have absolute control of his future. At the same time, I think the average Christian that isn't involved in those cults and all, the average Christian doesn't give man enough control. We just, everything, you know, something blows up in our face and it's our fault and we say, well, I guess it just wasn't God's will. And we act like we're 0.005, we have that much control, percent control over our lives. And I think God's actually given us much more control than we're willing to admit at times. At the same time, none of us can say that we're in full control of our lives. The example I gave about the amount of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. But this passage here can be used to refute several heresies that are popular today. And all of these heresies, by the way, ultimately turn man into a god. Okay? The health, wealth, and prosperity heresy, that you just gotta, you know, basically it's the name it and claim it movement, the positive confession movement. As long as you make positive confessions, they'll come about. Your speech and your thoughts determine your reality. The mind science cults, like the Christian Scientists or the Unity School of Christianity or Religious Science, where you create your own reality through the power of your mind. And then New Age optimism, the idea that we are all gods, we're all part of God, and we have infinite human potential. All ultimately, if man is in full control, if man is fully sovereign, 100%, ultimately you put God on the throne, and that's where everyone, even the health, wealth, and prosperity doctrine, which started as a Christian heresy, now has reached the point where they've stepped, I believe, outside of Christianity, and they claim man is Christians are gods with a small g, whatever that's supposed to mean. But James chapter 4, verse 17, the conclusion of this chapter, James says, therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do, and by the way, I'm not going to mention any names, we're not here to slam people, so I'm not going to mention Hagen, Copeland, Price, Casey Treat. I refuse to mention any names right now. James chapter 4, verse 17. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Sinning is not just doing the wrong thing. Sinning is also not doing the right thing. You know, the Christian who sits at home all day watching TV is sinning, even if he or she isn't getting drunk, getting involved in immorality, cursing, or beating people up. I mean, if you just are spending your time doing something other than the right thing that God has called you to do, you know, let's face it, every one of us has to take care of our families and that type of thing. So if you're pounding nails, you're obeying the Lord, if that's what it takes to put food on the table for your family. But even when you get home, even if you're a little tired or whatever, you might need rest for work, and that might be God's will for you to go to bed a little early. At the same time, if you're just being lazy, you're out of God's will. Sinning is also not doing the right thing that you know that God commands you to do. So God has commanded us not to do certain things. You know, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't murder. But he's also commanded us to do certain things. And so if you know the right thing to do and you don't do it, that is sin as much as doing the evil thing is sin. Not doing the right thing is also sin. And on the word sin, Bill Herod enters the room. And okay, James chapter 5. Yep. We'll make sure we censor that out, Kirk. James 5, verses 1 to 11. These verses talk about, James tells the rich to weep, and he tells the poor to be patient. So it's the weeping rich and the patient poor. James 5, verses 1 to 11. James talks about the judgment, God's judgment on the greedy rich in verses 1 to 6. I agree with Douglas Moo that he's talking to non-believers. These rich here, the wealthy businessmen in the passage we just covered, those appear to be believing businessmen because he tells them that they should recognize that the Lord's in control. But when you come to James chapter 5 and you look at what these rich guys are doing, And James is the guy who said faith without works is dead. It's pretty obvious that James is telling these guys, man, you guys are cranking up the furnace. It's getting hotter and hotter on a judgment day for you guys. It becomes pretty obvious that James does not consider these guys to be saved. The weeping rich and the patient poor. Maybe if you could pass that on to Kyle, I'd like to see Refuge base a song on that theme. But judgment on the greedy rich, verses 1 to 6. Now, the early church was predominantly made up of poor, persecuted people. Okay, we're trying to really key on the words that start with the letter P right now. The wealthy were often, especially of the Palestine area, even Jerusalem, the wealthy were often non-believers who took advantage of the poor. Let's take a look at verse 1 where James tells the rich to weep and howl. James chapter 5, verse 1. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. The miseries that are coming upon him. He's talking about the judgment, the coming judgment. Now, this could be taken in two ways. In 70 AD, you're talking probably about, at the most, 25 years after this letter was written, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, which, by the way, is a type of the second coming of Christ. When you look at Matthew 24, Jesus answers two questions in one shot. The destruction of Jerusalem, of the temple in Jerusalem, plus the second coming of Christ. So the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem was in 70 AD by the Romans was a type of the second coming of Christ, when Christ comes in judgment upon those who rejected him. I think ultimately what James has in mind is the second coming of Christ, and he's viewing the the rich men of his day, who are suppressing the poor, taking advantage of the poor, as kind of symbolic, if you will, of all the evil rich who suppress the poor. But the fact of the matter is, James throughout does talk about the coming of the Lord being at hand. Okay, this is common in the New Testament. At the same time, when Peter gets pressed on the issue, he says, yeah, but with the Lord, a day is as a thousand years is as a day. I agree with Douglas' view that the view of the early church was that when they said the coming of the Lord was at hand, what they were talking about was that there is basically the Lord came, died for our sins, rose from the dead, ascended to heaven. In the prophetic timeline, there are a few major events that have to occur before his return, but those events could possibly come down in our lifetime. Therefore, we need to live as if he might return in our lifetime, because that is a possibility. In other words, I see the doctrine of imminence not as the doctrine of the any moment return of Christ. Douglas Moo, by the way, would agree with me. He is also a post-tribber, like myself. He interprets imminency, the urgency that the early church had about the soon return, the possible soon return of Christ, not as that Christ could return at any moment, but that Christ could return in any generation, including their own. They knew the temple had to be destroyed before Christ returned. They knew Peter had to die of old age, based on a prophecy that Jesus gave earlier. So, what's that?
John had to die of old age.
What I meant was, they knew Peter had to die at old age. Men would take it, stretch out his arms. When you're a young man, you go where you please. You know, you're a tough guy, Peter. You just dragged all these fish ashore all by yourself when the other guys, even with the help of water, couldn't put it in the boat. You're a tough guy now. You go where you please. But when you get older and your hair turns white, they're gonna stretch out your arms and take you where you don't want to go. So the early church knew that Peter had to become old and then be put to death. The temple had to be destroyed before Christ could return, and the nation of Israel had to turn back and trust in Jesus as their Messiah. But when he talks about judgment is coming, he might be talking about the fact that, hey, in God's prophetic timeline, since Jesus has already died for our sins and risen from the dead, the coming of the Lord is near. It could come any generation. And you wealthy people who are putting down God's people who are mainly poor, you need to take note, because judgment is coming. It's right around the corner. And the evil rich of James' generation did not see the second coming of Christ, but they sure did see one of the biggest types of that, and that was the destruction of the temple and the destruction of the whole city of Jerusalem in 70 AD, which means whatever prosperous businesses they had there at that time, you can kiss that goodbye. Anyway, the four sins of the rich are mentioned in verses 2 to 6. The first sin that James mentions is their greediness, verses 2 to 3 of James chapter 5. Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Okay? So their greediness, they weren't faithful stewards. Wealth is to be used for good purposes. Basically said, wealth is to be used for God's purposes. God created us all to glorify Him, and so non-believers should turn to Christ for salvation and then should glorify Him with whatever, you know, way God has blessed them. Wealth is not to be stored away and hoarded. James speaks about the last days here. the last days, from a biblical standpoint, actually starts with Christ's birth. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2 says, and basically in days gone by, God spoke to us through the prophets and through the angels in many diverse ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us through his Son. So the last days actually started with Christ's birth. You know, the question comes up, are we in the last days? The answer is yes, because even the New Testament authors, the Apostle John, James, repeatedly stated that we were in the last days. But prophetically speaking, once the Messiah is on the scene, we're in the last days. But the next great event that we await is Christ's return. Of course, there's a few things that got to come down first, like the destruction of the temple, the rise of the Antichrist. But what James's point is that the rich didn't realize that they were already in the last days and they were living for today. And he's saying, look, Christ could return in our generation. You guys are living like physical life is going to go on forever and ever, and you're not going to have to worry about dying, and your wealth acting as if your wealth is going to last forever. By the way, talking about the rotting away of the garments and that type of thing, again, it sounds like the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 to 24, and right in that area where the Lord says to build your treasures in heaven, not treasures on earth, because, you know, moths will come in and it'll rot and it'll decay and waste away. And so the fact that material wealth is transitory, it's temporary, it's not going to be here forever. James seems to be alluding to that passage. But they were greedy and they were hoarding in all their, storing away their wealth rather than sharing their wealth and using it for God's purposes, like helping the poor and furthering the spreading of the gospel. Number two, it's found in verse 4, they refused to pay their workers. Look at verse 4. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. So they refused to pay their workers. God has heard the cries of these workers. Now, the Lord of the Sabaoth, or the Lord of the Sabbath, it's basically it's the Lord of Hosts. The armies of heaven, of heavens, the heavenly hosts, the angelic armies. And so again, James, as throughout his epistle, seems to be alluding to the end time judgment when Christ returns in power and glory with his angels. Matthew 24, a good passage there that will deal with this, as will Revelation 19, but we'll just look at Matthew 24, 19 to 21, if you want to look at later Revelation 19, 11 to 20. But Matthew 24, 29 to 31, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Now, when you go to Revelation 19, 11 to, I believe, about verse 20, it talks about Christ returning riding a white stallion, and behind him are the armies of heaven also riding on white stallions. And so there's Christ as the Lord of hosts returning with the armies of heaven. And the Lord's basically saying, you guys are going to reap what you sowed. God has allowed you to prosper, and instead of being thankful and sharing that wealth, you're abusing your workers and refusing to pay them. Well, when the Lord Jesus returns with the armies of heaven, you better watch out, because the judgment is going to be upon you. Verse 5 is the third sin of the rich. They lived a life of materialistic excess and selfish pleasure. Verse 5 of chapter 5. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. He's alluding to here in this passage the fact that the livestock was fattened until the day of slaughter. You know, if you have a bull, you just keep feeding it and getting it bigger and bigger and bigger, and then when it comes time for some steak, you get a lot of meat out of it. And what James is saying, you know, you can't take this stuff with you. You know, we came into this world with nothing. You're going to leave with nothing. And so all you're doing by hoarding your wealth, you're basically just fattening yourself up for the slaughter on the day of judgment. And so he's alluding to that. And again, he's pointing out the rich were unaware of the coming judgment. So they're selfish pleasures. Verse 6, they actually murdered the poor, according to James. And we'll talk about what he could possibly mean there. James 5, verse 6. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. So they murdered the poor. Now, they weren't paying the poor, so, you know, it is possible that there might have been people actually starving to death. We know that there was some hard times for the Palestine Jews at this time, and especially in Jerusalem, and Paul was always taking collections for them real early in church history. He talks about that in 1 Corinthians and in some of his other letters. And so, times are really rough. And if the poor weren't getting paid, you know, they probably thought, hey, I'll go out there and work real hard and get some money and buy some food for my family. They go out and work real hard. And then this rich guy turns around and says, hey, we didn't sign any contract. You just assumed I was going to pay you. I didn't say anything about paying you. So I don't know if it got to the point where they were actually starving to death.
One of the notes in my Luke King James application, kind of alluded to that, that it was very, very hard time. People were starving.
Yeah, and it could have been, you know, a rich guy could have said, hey, that's not my problem. I'm a businessman who, you know, makes deals and stuff and this and that and blah blah blah, and he just wasn't able to wheel and deal with me, and that's it. You know, if he starved to death, that's his fault and that type of thing. And James could be saying, no, the fact of the matter is I've seen people who have starved to death, yet they were working hard for people who didn't pay them. So that could be a possibility. Another possibility is, again, he always seems to go back to the Sermon on the Mount. And just to harbor an evil thought against a brother, Jesus said, you've already violated the command, thou shalt not kill. So it is possible that James is using murder in the sense of basically God's definition of murder, which is a lot stricter than our definition of murderer. None of us in this room are murderers. Hopefully, you know, I don't know everything about you guys, but in God's definition of the word murder, we've all murdered people at different times in our lives, and it's not as bad as physically murdering them, but we've harbored evil thoughts against them, and that type of thing. He says they condemned the poor. Look at James chapter 2, verse 6. James says, but you have dishonored the poor man. Is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court? Now he's talking to people who are poor, the readers, the Christian readers of this epistle, and they were showing favoritism to the rich. And he's saying, well, why are you showing favoritism to the rich? Isn't it the rich people who are persecuting you guys and dragging you guys unjustly into court? So it's hard to believe with such a such a squared away legal system as we have in this country today, but people, there were probably ways you could figure out how to sue people for what they, little they had and take it all from them. Now in this day and age, it's usually the big businesses that are getting sued, so maybe the shoe's on the other foot right now, but they're unjustly being being sued. It's taxation that's killing the poor. Whatever the case, they were actually dragging the poor into court and suing them. And it's kind of the idea. It's like when Nathan the prophet went to King David and said, "Hey, let me tell you a story. There was a guy who owned, you know, hundreds of sheep, and then there was this little poor man who only owned one beautiful sheep, and so this guy killed him and took his sheep from him." And, you know, David said, "Oh, well, let that guy's judgment come upon him sevenfold." And then Nathan the prophet pointed at David and said, "Behold the man. You're the guy, David. You stole Uriah the Hittite's wife, and then you murdered him in the, to cover up your sin." But it's that kind of idea. These wealthy guys who have all this wealth turn around and are willing to drag a poor man into court and take what little that he has. But I do know people like that who have so much that you would assume that what little the little guys got, that they would want nothing to do with it. But it's a lot of these people are like control freaks, that it's like, even though I've got $1 million and you've only got $30, I want that $30, or I want control of what you're doing here or there. And so, you know, this kind of thing still does go on at times. By the way, when you look at this passage, treating your poor workers like trash, not paying them for the work that they've done, it makes it pretty hard for me to believe that true believers. Now there were some slave owners that treated their slaves not as equals, but like servants, but at least treated them with some dignity and didn't beat them and that type of thing, and fed them well, and actually gave them some of the fruit of their work. But for the most part, the typical slave master of the South, putting a whip to a black man's back, never paying him a dime, forcing him to live in poverty and work in extreme heat and that type of thing, I think James would have a pretty hard time saying, "Oh yeah, that slave master's messed up in that area, but he's a believer." It seems to me like James would say, "Hey, look, you rich plantation owner, if you're going to treat your hard workers like that, not pay them, treat them like garbage, and beat them like that, you're just fattening up your heart for the day of judgment." So, I just have a hard time with people who assume that you can be a ruthless slave owner. And guys like Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. Now, Jefferson wasn't a believer because of his doctrine. You know, he rejected the deity of Christ. He was a lot nicer to his slaves than most. But even there, what's that?
Washington.
Yeah. But even there, you find them, you find views that Jefferson early on argued that they were less than human. But then as time went on, he was talking about, no, they're humans, and we should free them. But if we free them, they won't be able to figure out how to live on their own. They're so used to living this other way. So I'll just treat them real nice. And they're throwing things around, but you saw a lot of guilt. But our founding fathers did. The founding fathers from Virginia on up, most of them wanted to end slavery because Thomas Jefferson penned, "All men are created equal and given inalienable rights, and God instituted human government to protect those rights." So they figured, hey, how can we give that as an excuse to the world why we're revolting against England, and then turn around and enslave, you know, and treat our slaves like this? So the North actually said we ought to set the slaves free, but it was the Southern states, because their economy was so wrapped up in that said, hey, we'll side with Great Britain if you don't let us keep our slaves. And so the founding fathers said, okay, well, we'll have to settle this issue later. And it did get settled later on in the Civil War. But I have a hard time believing a ruthless slave owner puts a whip to a slave's back and doesn't pay his worker. I have a real hard time with that, and then saying, well, that guy was a believer, just a little messed up in that area. And by the way, the slavery of the Bible, when you, it's kind of like the slavery today. If you're in debt to somebody, and most of us are, you're somebody's slave. You're not working for yourself. You're working for your credit card or your bank or whatever. And that's the way slavery was back then, but it was a little bit more obvious, but I think it was a little bit more honest. You know, they don't call us slaves now. They call us prosperous, even if that couch that you bought last week was a couch that you bought with money that you're not going to be earning until the year 2010. But it got pretty brutal, though, too, even with that slavery that was in the Bible. If the guy couldn't pay off his debt and then he had children, well, these little innocent children now become his slaves, and he could turn around and sell these slaves. So it became a ruthless thing as well. But I don't think it was as bad as enslaving a man just for the color of his skin. But whatever the case, persecution in the church was beginning to start. Now, about 5 years earlier, the Apostle James, the brother of John, the son of Zebedee, was beheaded, put to death by Herod. No offense, Bill. Take a look at John 15. America is the exception. America is not the rule. When it comes to persecution, Jesus said in John 15, verses 18 to 20, if the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. We grew up in a nation that was so influenced by Christianity, and there's so much respect for the Bible, that even if the non-Christians outnumber the Christians have enjoyed tremendous freedom in this country. That's swiftly beginning to change. At the same time, I think a good portion of the professing Christian church still is receiving zero persecution in this country, and the problem there is that the professing Christian church looks too much like the world for the world to hate it. When you vote like the world votes, when you talk like the world talks, when you counsel like the world counsels, when you watch the same shows they watch and do the same things they do, and I mean, if you don't look different than them, they consider you one of their own. And so I think the Christian is going to stand up for Christ. The further we, as time moves forward in this country, we're going to be experiencing more and more persecution. I think right now we're just at the tip of the iceberg. Real early in my Christian walk, I did not consider myself a fire-breathing Christian, you know, just this Bible-banging Christian. I consider myself as being pretty sloppy and just beginning to really decide to follow the Lord, yet it was plastered all over my Marine Corps records. Very religious. It was a CO's remark, Colonel Taylor. Very religious, comma, still manages to do a good job. So, you know, I caught a lot of flack, and I was always being accused of fraternizing with the troops because I was an E4, a corporal, taking privates to prayer meetings in the church. When I knew sergeants and gunny sergeants who would take privates out to get them drunk, and they never got in trouble. But there was a big fear that I was going to turn all these Marines into wimps when, you know, me and my buddies were Christians and we were all benching over 300, and it was like, I just don't know. But, you know, it was just basically some persecution, but that's an extreme case in the Marine Corps, but I think that's going to become more and more common. Let me just say this about persecution. When we go to Mountain View Middle School, okay, for our Sunday services, it's a gun-free zone. That's the big sign, gun-free zone, okay? Well, it's also pretty much, even though the laws really do not, the courts are misinterpreting the laws as what it is, but...
Is that really true?
But, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's okay, just don't pack next time you go. But it's a gun-free zone, most of the public school, all the public schools today, but they're pretty much, for all practical purposes, Bible-free zones, too. I don't know why they would use, you know, they might as well just take the word free out and just say no religious freedom here, no right to bear arms here. But what it amounts to, what I'm getting at, is all we have to do is just apply the rules that are being enforced, or the implicit or explicit rules that are being enforced in the public schools, just apply them throughout this country across the boards, and we will have no religious freedom in this country. And recently, some federal court of appeals ruled against a school that was having prayer over the loudspeakers in the public schools. And I don't care which side you fall on that issue, the federal court of appeals was wrong. They ruled that it was that school had violated the First Amendment. The First Amendment doesn't tell anybody except Congress. Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In other words, the only one who can violate the First Amendment is Congress. It's the only one whose hands are tied. Now, maybe they could say, well, something else has gone on here. Well, then call it what it is. So whatever a person's view is about prayer in the public schools, because I don't want people over the loudspeaker doing mantras in the public schools, if they're not with my taxpayers' money. But at the same time, even if that was occurring, that still would not be a violation of the First Amendment unless Congress ruled that the public school is supposed to do that. But basically, the public schools are supposed to be run on the local levels.
That's just but the public schools, though, right?
What?
I was just curious. I just wondered if the U.S. Navy was violating the Constitution every time I'm underway by having an evening prayer at 10 o'clock.
No, to be totally honest with you, there's... We're not in a philosophy of government, but basically our founding fathers viewed atheism. Our founding fathers viewed atheism as treason, pretty much. I mean, the whole political economic experiment in this country was based on the belief that all men are created equal. Now, Thomas Jefferson chose to worship that Creator God differently than Ben Franklin. But George Washington or John Adams. Yet, none of those guys saw any problem with praying, starting out Congress in prayer. See, basically, the idea of the God of the Bible, very loosely interpreted, but the God of the Bible, the God of the Judeo-Christian heritage, in its wider sense, that was the God who guaranteed the freedom that we've experienced in this country. Not the tyrannical God of Islam, not the New Age God or the Hinduistic, Buddhistic type God. But at the same time, it was basically, this Creator God has given us our freedoms. Now, how you respond to this, your religious expression, how you respond to this Creator God is your own choice. We can't force you to join the Church of America or the Church of England or the Baptist Church or whatever. But for all practical purposes, it was a separation between natural revelation and supernatural revelation, God's revelation in nature versus God's revelation in Scripture. And even the quote-unquote liberal thinkers of that day believed that God was the one who guaranteed, gave the inalienable right. There is no concept of inalienable rights. There are no human rights in a godless universe. So, but whatever the case, anyway, so the rich are told to mourn and weep, but the poor are told to be patient in the midst of their trials, verses 7 to 11. Look at verses 7 and 8 of James 5. Be patient, therefore, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. Behold, the farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. So the poor are told to be patient. Be patient until the coming of the Lord. Now, there was two rainy seasons in Palestine, the early rain between October and November, and the latter rain between April and May. Both rains were crucial for the success of crops, just as both comings of Christ, the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ, are needed to bring justice on the earth. The first time he came to solve this problem of sin and to save our souls, the second time he's coming to basically redeem the planet earth. And so James's message is, hey, be patient. Christ will return to judge our enemies. Now, you get the same message from John in the book of Revelation. In both Revelation 13 and verse 10 and Revelation 14 verses 9 to 12. We'll just look at Revelation 14, 9 to 12. At just verses 9 to 11 says, hey, if anybody accepts the mark of the beast, the 666 on the forehead or right hand, they're going to burn in hell forever. That's what those verses say. So then in verse 12, because of that, the Apostle John states this: here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. So he's saying is, the reason why you can endure the sufferings, the persecution that you're under, is because you know that Jesus will return and he will judge those who have persecuted you, and they will pay the penalty, full cost, for the persecution that they brought upon you. So it's the same thing that James is saying here. Hey, be patient.